slopes. In the summer, he allowed local farmers to graze their sheep and goats there, not unlike what the peasants once indentured to the Schloss had done for the Graf, to keep the grass down to a reasonable height. Well, it was far more democratic now, wasn't it? It even gave him a break on the complex taxes put in place by the left-wing government of his country, and, more to the point, it looked good. His personal car was a Mercedes Stretch, two of them, in fact, and a Porsche, when he felt adventurous enough to drive himself to the nearby village for drinks and dinner, in the outstanding Gasthaus there. He was a tall man, 1 meter, 86 centimeters, with regal gray hair and a trim, fit figure that looked good on the back of one of his Arabian horses. You couldn't live in a home such as this one without horses, of course. Or when holding a business conference in a suit made in Italy, or on London's Savile Row. His office, on the second floor, had been the spacious library of the original owner and 8 of his descendants. But it was now aglow with computer displays linked to the world's financial markets and arrayed on the credenza behind a desk. After a light breakfast, he headed upstairs to his office, where 3 employees, 2 female and 1 male, kept him supplied with coffee, breakfast pastry, and information. The room was large and suitable for entertaining a group of 20 or so. The walnut-paneled walls were covered with bookshelves filled with books that had been conveyed with the Schloss, and whose titles Ostermann had never troubled himself to examine. He read the financial papers rather than literature, and in his spare time caught movies in a private screening room in the basement, a former wine cellar converted to the purpose. All in all, he was a man who lived a comfortable and private life in the most comfortable and private of surroundings. On his desk, when he sat down, was a list of people to visit him today. 3 bankers and 2 traders like himself, the former to discuss loans for a new business he was underwriting, and the latter to seek his counsel on market trends. It fed Osterman's already sizable ego to be consulted on such things, and he welcomed all manner of guests. Popoff stepped off his airliner and walked onto the concourse alone, like any other businessman, carrying his attaché case with its combination lock, and not a single piece of metal inside, lest some magnetometer operator ask him to open it and so reveal the paper currency inside. Terrorists had really ruined air travel for everyone, the former KGB officer thought to himself. Were someone to make the baggage scanners more sophisticated, enough to count money inside carry-on baggage, for example, it would further put a dent in the business affairs of many people, including himself. Traveling by train was so boring. Their tradecraft was good. Hans was at his designated location, sitting there, reading Der Spiegel, and wearing the agreed-upon brown leather jacket. And he saw Dmitri Arkadyevich, carrying his black attaché case in his left hand, striding down the concourse with all the other business travelers. Fortner finished his coffee and left to follow him, trailing Popoff by about 20 meters, angling off to the left so that they took different exits, crossing over to the parking garage by different walkways. Popoff allowed his head to turn left and right, caught Hans on the first sweep, and observed how he moved. The man had to be tense, Popoff knew. Betrayal was how most of the people, like Fürkner, got caught. And though Dmitri was known and trusted by them, you could only be betrayed by someone whom you trusted, a fact known to every covert operator in the world. And though they knew Popoff both by sight and reputation, they couldn't read minds, which of course worked quite well for Popoff in this case. He allowed himself a quiet smile as he walked into the parking garage, turned left, stopped as though disoriented, and then looked around for any overt signs that he was being followed before finding his bearings and moving on his way. Forkner's car proved to be in a distant corner on the first level, a blue Volkswagen Golf.
"Grüß Gott," he said, on sitting in the right front seat.
"Good morning, Herr Popov," Forkner replied in English. It was American in character and almost without accent. He must have watched a lot of television, Dmitri thought. The Russian dialed the combinations into the locks of the case, opened the lid, and placed it in his host's lap.
"You should find everything in order."
"Bulky," the man observed.
"It is a sizable sum," Popov agreed.
Just then suspicion appeared in Ferkner's eyes. That surprised the Russian, until he thought about it for a moment. The KGB had never been lavish in their payments to their agents, but in this attaché case was enough cash to enable two people to live comfortably in any of several African countries for a period of some years. Hans was just realizing that, Dmitri saw, and while part of the German was content just to take the money, the smart portion of his brain suddenly wondered where the money had come from. Better not to wait for the question, Dmitri thought.
"Ah, yes," Popov said quietly. "As you know, many of my colleagues have outwardly turned capitalist in order to survive in my country's new political environment. But we are still the sword and shield of the party, my young friend. That has not changed. It is ironic, I grant you, that now we are better able to compensate our friends for their services. It turns out to be less expensive than maintaining the safe houses which you once enjoyed. I personally find that amusing. In any case, here is your payment, in cash, in advance, in the amount you specified."
"Danke," Hans Ferkner observed, staring down into the attaché case's 10 centimeters of depth. Then he hefted the case.
"It's heavy."
"True," Dmitri Arkadyevich agreed.
"But it could be worse. I might have paid you in gold," he joked, to lighten the moment, then decided to make his own play.
"Too heavy to carry on the mission?"
"It is a complication, Yosef Andreyevich."
"Well, I can hold the money for you and come to you to deliver it upon the completion of your mission. That is your choice, though I do not recommend it."
"Why is that?" Hans asked.
"Honestly, it makes me nervous to travel with so much cash. The West, well, what if I am robbed? This money is my responsibility," he replied theatrically. Ferkner found that very amusing. "Here, in Österreich, robbed on the street. My friend, these capitalist sheep are very closely regulated."
"Besides, I do not even know where you will be going, and I really do not need to know. At this time, anyway."
"The Central African Republic is our ultimate destination. We have a friend there who graduated Patrice Lumumba University back in the 60s. He trades in arms to progressive elements. He will put us up for a while, until Petra and I can find suitable housing." They were either very brave or very foolish to go to that country, Popov thought. Not so long before, it had been called the Central African Empire, and had been ruled by Emperor Bokassa I, a former colonel in the French colonial army, which had once garrisoned this small, poor nation. Bokassa had killed his way to the top, as had so many African chiefs of state, before dying, remarkably enough, of natural causes. So the papers said, anyway. You could never really be sure, could you? The country he'd left behind, a small diamond producer, was somewhat better off economically than was the norm on the Dark Continent, though not by much. But then who was to say that Hans and Petra would ever get there?
"Well, my friend, it is your decision," Popov said.
patting the attaché case still open in Ferkner's lap. The German considered that for half a minute or so. "I have seen the money," he concluded, to his guest's utter delight. Ferkner lifted a 1,000-note packet of the cash and riffled it like a deck of cards before putting it back. Next he scribbled a note and placed it inside the case. "There is the name. We will be with him starting late tomorrow, I imagine. All is ready on your end?" "The American aircraft carrier is in the eastern Mediterranean. Libya will allow your aircraft to pass without interference, but will not allow overflights of any NATO aircraft following you. Instead, their air force will provide the coverage and will lose you due to adverse weather conditions. I will advise you not to use more violence than is necessary. Press and diplomatic pressure has more strength today than it once did."
"We have thought that one through," Hans assured his guest.
Popov wondered briefly about that. But he'd be surprised if they even boarded an aircraft, much less got it to Africa. The problem with missions like this one was that no matter how carefully most of its parts had been considered, this chain was decidedly no stronger than its weakest link. And the strength of that link was all too often determined by others, or by chance, which was even worse. Hans and Petra were believers in their political philosophy, and, like earlier people who'd believed so much in their religious faith so as to take the most absurd of chances, they would pretend to plan this mission through with their limited resources. And when you got down to it, their only resource was their willingness to apply violence to the world. And lots of people had that. And substitute hope for expectations, belief for knowledge. They would accept random chance, one of their deadliest enemies, as a neutral element, when a true professional would have sought to eliminate it entirely. And so their belief structure was really a blindfold, or perhaps a set of blinkers, which denied the two Germans the ability to look objectively at a world that had passed them by, and to which they were unwilling to adapt. But for Popov, the real meaning of this was their willingness to let him hold the money. Dmitri Arkadyevich had adapted himself quite well to changing circumstances.
"Are you sure, my young friend?"
"Yeah, I am sure." Ferkner closed the case, reset the locks, and passed it over to Popov's lap. The Russian accepted the responsibility with proper gravity.
"I will guard this carefully. All the way to my bank in Bern."
Then he extended his hand.
"Good luck, and please be careful."
"Danke. We will get you the information you require."
"My employer needs that badly, Hans. We depend on you."
Dmitri left the car and walked back in the direction of the terminal, where he'd get a taxi to his hotel. He wondered when Hans and Petra would make their move. Perhaps today? Were they that precipitous? No, he thought, they would say that they were that professional. The young fools. Sergeant First Class Homer Johnston extracted the bolt from his rifle, which he lifted to examine the bore. The 10 shots had dirtied it some, but not much, and there was no erosion damage that he could see in the throat forward of the chamber. None was to be expected until he'd fired 1,000 or so rounds, and he'd only put 540 through it to this point. Still, in another week or so, he'd have to start using a fiber-optic instrument to check, because the 7mm Remington Magnum cartridge did develop high temperatures when fired, and the excessive heat burned up barrels a little faster than he would have preferred. In a few months, he'd have to replace the barrel, a tedious and fairly difficult exercise even for a skilled armorer, which he was. The difficulty was in matching the barrel perfectly with the receiver, which would then require 50 or so rounds on the known distance range to to make sure that it delivered its rounds as accurately as it was intended to do. But that was in the future. Johnston sprayed a moderate amount of Break Free onto the cleaning patch and ran it through the barrel back to front. The patch came out dirty. He removed it from the cleaning rod, then put a new one on the tip, and repeated the motion 6 times until the last patch came through totally clean. A final clean patch dried the bore of the select-grade Hart barrel, though the break-free cleaning solvent left a thin, not much more than a molecule's thickness, coating of silicon on the steel, which protected against corrosion without altering the microscopic tolerances of the barrel. Finished and satisfied, he replaced the bolt, closing it on an empty chamber with the final act of pulling the trigger, which decocked the rifle as it dropped the bolt into proper position. He loved the rifle, though somewhat surprisingly he hadn't named it. Built by the same technicians who made sniper rifles for the United States Secret Service, it was a 7mm Remington Magnum caliber, with a Remington match-quality receiver, a select-grade Hart barrel, and Leupold 10-power gold-ring telescopic sight, all married to an ugly Kevlar stock. Wood would have been much prettier, but wood warped over time, whereas Kevlar was dead, chemically inert, unaffected by moisture or time. Johnston had just proven, again, that his rifle could fire at about 1/4 of a minute of angle's accuracy, meaning that he could fire 3 consecutive rounds inside the diameter of a nickel at 100 yards. Someday somebody might design a laser weapon, Johnston thought, and maybe that could improve on the accuracy of this handmade rifle. But nothing else could. At a range of 1,000 yards, he could put 3 consecutive rounds into a circle of 4 inches. That required more than a rifle. That meant gauging the wind for speed and direction to compensate for drift deflection. It also meant controlling his breathing and the way his finger touched the 2.5-pound double-set trigger. His clean-up tasks done, Johnston lifted the rifle and carried it to its place in the gun vault, which was climate-controlled, and nestled it where it belonged before going back to the bullpen. The target he'd shot was on his desk. Homer Johnston lifted it. He'd shot 3 rounds at 400 meters, 3 at 500, 2 at 700, and his last 2 at 900. All 10 were inside the head shape of the silhouette target, meaning that all 10 would have been instantly fatal to a human target. He shot only cartridges that he'd loaded himself. Sierra 175-grain hollow-point boat-tailed match bullets traveling in front of 63.5 grains of IMR 4350 smokeless powder seemed to be the best combination for that particular rifle, taking 1.7 seconds to reach a target 1,000 yards downrange. That was an awfully long time, especially against a moving target, Sergeant Johnston thought, but it couldn't be helped. A hand came down on his shoulder.
"Homer?" a familiar voice said.
"Yeah, Dieter," Johnston said, without looking up from the target. He was in the zone all the way in. Shame it wasn't hunting season.
"You did better than me today. The wind was good for you."
It was Weber's favorite excuse. He knew guns pretty well for a European, Homer thought. But guns were American things, and that was that.
"I keep telling you that semi-automatic action doesn't headspace properly."
Both of Weber's 900-meter rounds were marginal. They would have incapacitated the target, but not definitely killed it, even though they scored as hits. Johnston was the best rifle in Rainbow, even better than Houston, by about 0.5 cunt hair on a good day, Homer admitted to himself.
"I like to get my second round off more quickly than you," Weber pointed out. And that was the end of the argument. Soldiers were as loyal to their firearms as they were to their religions.
The German was far better in rate of fire with his Golliwog Walther sniper rifle, but that weapon didn't have the inherent accuracy of a bolt action, and also fired a less speedy cartridge. The two riflemen had debated the point over many a beer already, and neither would ever move the other. In any case, Weber patted his holster.
"Some pistol, Homer?"
"Yeah."
Johnston stood. "Why not?"
Handguns were not serious weapons for serious work, but they were fun, and the rounds were free here. Weber had him faded in handguns by about 1% or so. On the way to the range, they passed Chavez, Price, and the rest, coming out with their MP10s, joking with one another as they passed. Evidently, everyone had had a good morning on the range.
"Ugh," Weber snorted, "anyone can shoot at 5 meters.
"Morning, Robert," Homer said to the rangemaster. "Want to set up some cues for us?"
"Quite so, Sergeant Johnston," Dave Woods replied, grabbing two of the American-style targets, called Q-targets, for the letter Q in the middle, about where the heart would be. Then he got a third for himself. A lavishly mustached color sergeant in the British Army Military Police Regiment, he was pretty damned good with a 9mm Browning. The targets motored down to the 10-meter line and turned sideways, while the three sergeants donned their ear protectors. Woods was, technically, a pistol instructor, but the quality of the men at Hereford made that a dull job, and as a result he himself fired close to 1,000 rounds per week, perfecting his own skills. He was known to shoot with the men of Rainbow, and to challenge them to friendly competition, which, to the dismay of the shooters, was almost a break-even proposition. Woods was a traditionalist, and held his pistol in one hand, as Weber did, though Johnston preferred the two-hand Weaver stance. The targets turned without warning, and three handguns came up to address them. The home of Erwin Ostermann was magnificent, Hans Furtner thought for the 10th time, just the sort of thing for an arrogant class enemy. Their research into the target hadn't revealed any aristocratic lineage for the current owner of this Schloss, but he doubtless thought of himself in those terms. For now, Hans thought, as he turned onto the 2-kilometer driveway of brown gravel and drove past the manicured gardens and bushes arranged with geometric precision by workers who were at the moment nowhere to be seen. Pulling up close to the palace, he stopped the rented Mercedes and turned right, as though looking for a parking place. Coming around the rear of the building, he saw the Sikorsky S-76B helicopter they'd be using later, sitting on the usual asphalt pad with a yellow circle painted on it. Good. Furtner continued the circuit around the Schloss and parked in front, about 50 meters from the main entrance.
"Are you ready, Petra?"
"Yeah,"
was her terse, tense reply.
It had been years since either had run an operation, and the immediate reality of it was different from the planning they'd spent a week to accomplish, going over charts and diagrams. There were things they did not yet know for certain, like the exact number of servants in the building. They started walking to the front door when a delivery truck came up, arriving there just as they did. The truck doors opened, and two men got out, both carrying large boxes in their arms. One waved to Hans and Petra to go up the stone steps, which they did. Hans hit the button, and a moment later the door opened.
"Guten Tag," Hans said. "We have an appointment with Herr Ostermann."
"Your name?"
"Bauer,"
Furtner said.
"Hans Bauer."
"Flower delivery," one of the other two men said.
"Please come in. I will call Herr Ostermann," the butler, whatever he was, said.
"Danke," Furtner replied, waving for Petra to precede him through the ornate door. The delivery men came in behind, carrying their boxes. The butler closed the door, then turned to walk left toward a phone. He lifted it and started to punch a button. Then he stopped.
"Why don't you take us upstairs?" Petra asked.
There was a pistol in her hand aimed right into his face.
"What is this?"
"This," Petra Dortmund replied with a warm smile, "is my appointment." It was a Walther P-38 automatic pistol. The butler swallowed hard as he saw the delivery men open their boxes and reveal light submachine guns, which they loaded in front of him. Then one of them opened the front door and waved. In seconds, two more young men entered, both similarly armed. Ferkner ignored the new arrivals and took a few steps to look around. They were in the large entrance foyer, its high 4-meter walls covered with artwork. Late Renaissance, he thought. Noteworthy artists, but not true masters. Large paintings of domestic scenes in gilt frames, which were in their way more impressive than the paintings themselves. The floor was white marble with black diamond inserts at the joins. The furniture, also largely gilt and French-looking. More to the point, there were no other servants in view, though he could hear a distant vacuum cleaner working. Ferkner pointed to the two most recent arrivals and pointed them west on the first floor. The kitchen was that way, and there would doubtless be people there to control.
"Where is Herr Ostermann?" Petra asked next.
"He is not here. He—"
This occasioned a movement of her pistol right against his mouth. "His automobiles and helicopter are here. Now, tell us where he is."
"In the library, upstairs."
"Good. Take us there," she ordered. The butler looked into her eyes for the first time and found them far more intimidating than the pistol in her hand. He nodded and turned toward the main staircase. This, too, was gilt, with a rich red carpet held in place with brass bars, sweeping on an elegant curve to the right as they climbed to the second floor. Ostermann was a wealthy man, a quintessential capitalist who'd made his fortune trading shares in various industrial concerns, never taking ownership in one. A string puller, Petra Dortmund thought. A spina. A spider. And this was the center of his web. And they'd entered it of their own accord. And here the spider would learn a few things about webs and traps. More paintings on the staircase, she saw, far larger than anything she'd ever done. Paintings of men. Probably the men who'd built and lived in this massive edifice. This monument to greed and exploitation. She already hated its owner, who lived so well, so opulently, so publicly proclaiming that he was better than everyone else, while he built up his wealth and exploited the ordinary workers. At the top of the staircase was a huge oil portrait of the Emperor Franz Joseph himself, the last of his wretched line, who died just a few years before the even more hated Romanovs. The butler, this worker for the evil one, turned right, leading them down a wide hall into a doorless room. Three people were there, a man and two women, better dressed than the butler, all working away at computers.
"This is Herr Bauer," the butler said in a shaky voice. "He wishes to see Herr Ostermann."
"You have an appointment?" the senior secretary asked.
"You will take us in now," Petra announced. Then the gun came into view, and the three people in the anteroom stopped what they were doing and looked at the intruders with open mouths and pale faces. Ostermann's home was several hundred years old, but not entirely a thing of the past. The male secretary, in America, he would have been called an executive assistant, was named Gerhard Dengler. Under the edge of his desk was an alarm button. He thumbed this hard and long while he stared at the visitors. The wire led to the Schloss's central alarm panel, and from there to the alarm company. 20 kilometers away, the employees at the central station responded to the buzzer and flashing light by immediately calling the office of the Staatspolizei. Then one of them called the Schloss for confirmation.
"May I answer it?" Gerhardt asked Petra, who seemed to him to be in charge. He got a nod and lifted the receiver.
"Herr Ostermann's office?"
"Here is Traudl," the alarm company secretary said.
"Guten Tag, Traudl. Here ist Gerhardt," the executive assistant said.
"Have you called about the horse?"
That was the phrase for serious trouble, called a duress code.
"Yes, when is the foal due?" she asked, carrying on to protect the man on the other end, should someone be listening in on the line.
"A few more weeks still."
"We will tell you when the time comes," he told her brusquely, staring at Petra and her pistol.
"Danke, Gerhardt. Wiedersehen."
With that, she hung up and waved to her watch supervisor.
"It is about horses," he explained to Petra. "We have a mare in foal and—"
"Silence," Petra said quietly, waving for Hans to approach the double doors into Ostermann's office. So far, she thought, so good. There was even some cause for amusement. Ostermann was right through those double doors, doing the work he did as though things were entirely normal, when they decidedly were not. Well, now it was time for him to find out. She pointed to the executive assistant.
"Your name is?"
"Dengler," the man replied.
"Gerhardt Dengler."
"Take us in, Herr Dengler," she suggested, in a strangely childlike voice.
Gerhardt rose from his desk and walked slowly to the double doors, head down, his movements wooden, as though his knees were artificial. Guns did that to people, Dortmund and Fürkner knew. The secretary turned the knobs and pushed, revealing Ostermann's office. The desk was huge, gilt like everything else in the building, and sat on a huge red wool rug. Erwin Ostermann had his back to them, head down, examining some computer display or other.
"Herr Ostermann," Dengler said. "Yes, Gerhardt," was the reply, delivered in an even voice, and when there was no response, the man turned in his swivel chair.
"What is this?" he asked, his blue eyes going very wide when he saw the visitors, and then wider still when he saw the guns.
"Who?"
"We are commanders of the Red Workers faction," Fürkner informed the trader, "and you are our prisoner."
"But what is this?"
"You and we will be taking a trip. If you behave yourself, you will come to no harm. If you do not, you and others will be killed. Is that clear?" Petra asked.
To make sure it was, she again aimed her pistol at Dengler's head. What followed then could have been scripted in a movie. Ostermann's head snapped left and right, looking for something, probably help of some sort, which was not to be seen. Then he looked back at Hans and Petra, and his face contorted itself into shock and disbelief. This could not be happening to him. Not here. Not in his own office. Next came the outraged denial of the facts he could see before him. And then, finally, came fear. The process lasted 5 or 6 seconds. It was always the same. She'd seen it before and realized that she'd forgotten how pleasurable it was to behold. Ostermann's hands balled into fists on the leather surface of his desk, then relaxed as his body realized how powerless it was. Trembling would start soon, depending on how much courage he might have. Petra didn't anticipate a great deal of that. He looked tall, even sitting down, thin, regal even in his white shirt with the starched collar and striped tie. The suit was clearly expensive, Italian silk probably, finely tailored just for him. Under the desk would be custom-made shoes, polished by a servant. Behind him, she could see lines of data marching upward on the computer screens. Here Osterman was, in the center of his web, and scarcely a minute before he'd been totally at ease, feeling himself invincible, master of his fate, moving money around the world, adding to his fortune. Well, no more of that for a while. Probably forever, though Petra had no intention of telling him that until the last possible second, the better to see the shock and terror on his regal face just before the eyes went blank and empty. She had forgotten how it was, Petra realized, the sheer joy of the power she held in her hands. How had she ever gone so long without exercising it? The first police car to arrive on the scene had been only 5 kilometers away on getting the radio call. Reversing direction and racing to the Schloss had only taken 3 minutes, and now it parked behind a tree, almost totally concealed from the house. "I see a car and a delivery truck," the officer told his station chief, a captain. "No movement. Nothing else to be seen at the moment." "Very well," the captain replied. "Take no action of any kind and report any new developments to me at once. I will be there in a few minutes." "Understood. Ende." The captain replaced the microphone. He was driving to the scene himself, alone in his Audi radio car. He'd met Osterman once, at some official function in Vienna. Just a shake of the hand and a few cursory words, but he knew what the man looked like, and knew his reputation as a wealthy, civic-minded individual who was an especially faithful supporter of the opera. And the children's hospital, wasn't he? Yes, that had been the reason for the reception at the City Hall. Osterman was a widower, had lost his first wife to ovarian cancer 5 years earlier. Now, it was said, he had a new interest in his life named Ursel von Prinze, a lovely, dark-haired woman from an old family. That was the odd thing about Osterman. He lived like a member of the nobility, but he'd come from humble roots. His father had been an engineer, engine driver, actually, in the state railway, wasn't it? Yes, that was right. And so some of the old noble families had looked down on him. And to take care of that, he'd bought social respectability with his charity work and his attendance at the opera. Despite the grandeur of his home, he lived fairly modestly. Little in the way of lavish entertaining. A quiet, modestly dignified man, and a very intelligent one, so they said of him. But now, his alarm company said, he had intruders in the house, Captain Willy Altmark told himself, taking the last turn and seeing the Schloss. As often as he'd noticed it in passing, he had to remind himself now of the physical circumstances. A huge structure, perhaps 400 meters of clear grass lawn between it and the nearest trees. Not good. Approaching the house covertly would be extremely difficult. He pulled his Audi close to the marked police car on the scene, and got out carrying a pair of binoculars. "Captain," the first officer said by way of greeting. "Have you seen anything?" "No movement of any kind, not even a curtain." Altmark took a minute to sweep his binoculars over the building, then lifted the radio mic to tell all units en route to come quietly and slowly, so as not to alert the criminals inside. Then he got a radio call from his superior, asking for his assessment of the situation. "This may be a job for the military," Captain Altmark responded. "We know nothing at the moment. I can see an automobile and a truck. Nothing else. No gardeners out. Nothing. But I can only see 2 walls and nothing behind the main house. I will get a perimeter set up as soon as additional units arrive." "Yeah. Make certain that no one can see us," the commissioner told the captain, quite unnecessarily. "Yes, of course." Inside, Osterman had yet to rise from his chair. He took a moment to close his eyes, thanking God that Ursel was in London at the moment, having flown there in the private jet to do some shopping and meet with English friends. He'd hoped to join her there the following day, and now he wondered if he'd ever see his fiancée again. Twice he'd been approached by security consultants, an Austrian and a Brit. Both had lectured him on the implicit dangers of being so publicly rich, and told him how for a modest sum, less than £500,000 per year, he could greatly improve his personal security. The Britisher had explained that his people were all veterans of the SAS. The Austrian had employed Germans formerly of GSG-9. But he hadn't seen the need for employing gun-carrying commandos who would hover over him everywhere he went, as though he were a chief of state, taking up space and just sitting there like bodyguards, Osterman told himself. As a trader in stocks, commodities, and international currencies, he'd had his share of missed opportunities. But this one...
What do you want of me?
We want your personal access codes to the International Trading Network, Ferkner told him. Hans was surprised to see the look of puzzlement on Osterman's face.
What do you mean?
The computer access codes which tell you what is going on.
But those are public already. Anyone can have them, Osterman objected.
Yes, certainly they are. That is why everyone has a house like this one. Petra managed an amused sneer.
Here, Osterman, Ferkner said patiently. We know there is a special network for people such as you, so that you can take advantage of special market conditions and profit by them.
You think us fools?
The fear that transformed the trader's face amused his two office guests. Yes, they knew what they weren't supposed to know, and they knew they could force him to give over the information. His thoughts were plain on his face.
Oh, my God, they think I have access to something that does not exist, and I will never be able to persuade them otherwise.
We know how people like you operate, Petra assured him, immediately confirming his fear. How you capitalists share information and manipulate your free markets for your own greedy ends. Well, you will share that with us. Or you will die along with your lackeys. She waved her pistol at the outer office.
I see.
Osterman's face was now as pale as his white Turnbull and Asser shirt. He looked out to the anteroom. He could see Gerhardt Dengler there, his hands on the top of his desk. Wasn't there an alarm system there? Osterman couldn't remember now, so rapidly was his mind running through the data avalanche that had so brutally interrupted his day. The first order of police business was to check the license plate numbers of the vehicles parked close to the house. The automobile, they learned at once, was a rental. The truck tags had been stolen 2 days before. A detective team would go to the car rental agency immediately to see what they might learn there. The next call was made to one of Herr Osterman's business associates. The police needed to know how many domestic and clerical employees might be in the building along with the owner. That, Captain Altmark imagined, would take about an hour. He now had three additional police cars under his command. One of these looped around the property so that the two officers could park and approach from the rear on foot. 20 minutes after arriving on the scene, he had a perimeter forming. The first thing he learned was that Osterman owned a helicopter, sitting there behind the house. It was an American-made Sikorsky S-76B, capable of carrying a crew of 2 and a maximum of 13 passengers. That information gave him the maximum number of hostages to be removed and criminals to move them. The helicopter landing pad was 200 meters from the house. Altmark fixed on that. The criminals would almost certainly want to use the helicopter as their getaway vehicle.
Unfortunately, the landing pad was a good 300 meters from the tree line. This meant that some really good riflemen were needed, but his preset response team had them. Soon after getting the information on the helicopter, one of his people turned up the flight crew, one at home, one at Shvekot International Airport, doing some paperwork with the manufacturer's representative for an aircraft modification. Good, Willy Altmark thought. The helicopter wasn't going anywhere just yet. But by then, the fact that Erwin Osterman's house had been attacked had perked up to the senior levels of government. And then he received a very surprising radio call from the head of the Staatspolizei. They barely made the flight. More precisely, the flight hadn't been delayed on their account. Chavez tightened his seatbelt as the 737 pulled back from the jetway, and went over the preliminary briefing documents with Eddie Price. They'd just rolled off the tarmac when Price mated his portable computer with the aircraft's phone system. That brought up a diagram on his screen, with the caption, Schloss Ostermann. "So, who is this guy?" Chavez asked.
"Coming in now, sir," Price replied. "A moneylender, it would appear, rather a wealthy one, friend of the Prime Minister of his country. I guess that explains matters so far as we are concerned."
"Yeah," Chavez agreed. Two in a row for Team Two was what he thought. A little over an hour's flight time to Vienna, he thought next, checking his watch. One such incident was happenstance, Chavez told himself. But terrorist incidents weren't supposed to happen so closely together, were they? Not that there was a rule book out there, of course. And even if there were such a thing, these people would have violated it. Still, but there was no time for such thoughts. Instead, Chavez examined the information coming into Price's laptop and started wondering how he'd deal with this new situation. Farther aft, his team occupied a block of economy seats and spent their time reading paperback books, hardly talking at all about the upcoming job, since they knew nothing to talk about except where they were going.
"Bloody large perimeter for us to cover," Price observed, after a few minutes.
"Any information on the opposition?" Ding asked, then wondered how it was that he was adopting Britspeak.
"Opposition?"
He should have said, "bad guys."
"None," Eddie replied. "No identification, no word on their numbers."
"Great," the leader of Team Two observed, still staring sideways at the screen.
The phones were trapped. Altmark had seen to that early on. Incoming calls were given busy signals, and outgoing calls would be recorded at the central telephone exchange. But there had been none, which suggested to Captain Altmark that the criminals were all inside, since they were not seeking external help. That could have meant they were using cellular phones, of course, and he didn't have the equipment to intercept those, though he did have similar traps on Osterman's 3 known cellular accounts. The Staatspolizei now had 30 officers on the scene, and a tight perimeter fully formed and punctuated by a 4-wheel armored vehicle, hidden in the trees. They'd stopped one delivery truck from coming in with some overnight express mail, but no other vehicles had attempted to enter the property. For one so wealthy, Osterman did indeed lead a quiet and unassuming life, the captain thought. He'd expected a constant parade of vehicles.
"Hans?"
"Yes, Petra?"
"The phones have not rung. We've been here for some time, but the phones have not rung."
"Most of my work is on computer," Osterman said, having noted the same discrepancy himself. Had Gerhardt gotten the word out? If he had done so, was that good? He had no way of knowing. Osterman had long joked about how cutthroat his profession was, how every step he took had danger, because others out there would try to rob him blind if they ever got the chance. But not one of them had ever threatened his life,
nor had any ever pointed a loaded gun at him or a member of his staff. Osterman used his remaining capacity for objectivity to realize that this was a new and dangerous aspect to the world that he'd never seriously considered, about which he knew very little, and against which he had nothing in the way of defenses. His only useful talent, at the moment, was his ability to read faces, and the minds behind them. And though he'd never encountered anyone even vaguely close to the man and woman in his office now, he saw enough to be more afraid than he'd ever been before. The man, and even more the woman, were willing to kill him without any pangs of conscience whatsoever, no more emotion than he showed when picking up $1 million of American T-bills. Didn't they know that his life had worth? Didn't they know that— No, Ervin Osterman realized. They did not. They didn't know, and they didn't care. Worst of all, what they thought they did know wasn't true, and he would be hard-pressed indeed to persuade them otherwise. Then, finally, a phone rang. The woman gestured for him to answer it. "Here ist Osterman," he said on picking up the receiver. His male visitor did the same on another extension. "Herr Osterman, I am Captain Wilhelm Altmark, of the Stadtpolizei. You have guests there, I understand."
"Yes, I do, Captain," Osterman replied.
"Could I speak with them, please?"
Osterman merely looked at Hans Furchtner.
"You took your time, Altmark," Hans said. "Tell me, how did you find out?"
"I will not ask you about your secrets if you do not ask me about mine," the captain replied coolly. "I would like to know who you are and what you wish."
"I am Commander Wolfgang of the Red Workers faction."
"And what is it you want?"
"We want the release of several of our friends from various prisons and transport to Schwekat International. We require an airliner with a range of more than 5,000 kilometers and an international flight crew for a destination which we will make known when we board the aircraft. If we do not have these things by midnight, we will begin to kill some of our guests here in Schloss Osterman."
"I see. Do you have a list of the prisoners whose release you require?"
Hans put one hand over the receiver and held the other out.
"Petra, the list."
She walked over and handed it to him. Neither seriously expected any cooperation on this issue, but it was part of the game, and the rules had to be followed. They decided on the way in that they'd have to kill one hostage, certainly, more probably two, before they got the ride to the airport. The man, Gerhard Dengler, would be killed first, Hans thought, then one of the women secretaries. Neither he nor Petra really wanted to kill any of the domestic help, since they were genuine workers, not capitalist lackeys like the office staff.
"Yes, here is the list, Captain Altmark."
"Okay," Price said. "We have a list of people we are expected to liberate for our friends." He turned the computer so that Chavez could see it.
"The usual suspects.
Does this tell us anything, Eddie?" Price shook his head.
"Probably not. You can get these names from a newspaper."
"So why do they do it?"
"Dr. Bello will explain that they have to show solidarity with their compatriots, when, in fact, they are all sociopaths who don't care a rip for anyone but themselves."
Price shrugged.
"Cricket has rules. So does terrorism, and—"
Just then the captain of the airliner interrupted the revelation and told everyone to put the seat backs up and tray tables away in preparation for landing.
"Showtime soon, Eddie."
"Indeed, Ding."
"So this is just solidarity bullshit?" Ding asked, tapping the screen.
"Most likely, yes." With that, Price disconnected the phone line from his computer, saved his files, and shut the laptop down.
12 rows aft, Tim Noonan did the same. All the Team 2 members started putting on their game faces as the British Airways 737 flared to land in Vienna. Someone had called ahead to someone else. The airliner taxied very rapidly indeed to its assigned jetway, and out his window Chavez could see a baggage truck with cops standing next to it, waiting alongside the terminal. It was not an invisible event. A tower controller noted the arrival, having already noted a few minutes before that a Sabena flight scheduled in a slot ahead of the British aircraft had been given an unnecessary go-around order, and that a very senior police officer was in the tower, expressing interest in the British Airways flight. Then there was a second and very unnecessary baggage train with two police cars close by the A4 jetway. What was this, he wondered. It required no great effort on his part to keep watch to learn more. He even had a pair of Zeiss binoculars. The stewardess hadn't received instructions to get Team 2 off more quickly than anyone else, but she suspected there was something odd about them. They'd arrived without having been on her computerized manifest, and they were politer than the average business travelers. Their appearances were unremarkable, except all looked very fit, and all had arrived together in a single bunch, and headed to their seats in an unusually organized way. She had a job to do, however, as she opened the door into the jetway, where, she saw, a uniformed policeman was waiting. He didn't smile or speak as she allowed the already standing passengers to make their way off. Three from first class stopped just outside the aircraft, conferred with the policeman, then went out the door to the service stairs, which led directly to the tarmac. Being a serious fan of thriller and mystery novels, it was worth a look, she thought, to see who else went that way. The total was 13, and the number included all of the late-arriving passengers. She looked at their faces, most of which gave her a smile on the way out. Handsome faces, for the most part. More than that, manly ones, with expressions that radiated confidence, and something else. Something conservative and guarded. "Au revoir, madame," the last one said as he passed, with a very Gallic evaluative sweep of her figure and a charming smile. "Christ, Louis," an American voice observed on the way out the side door. "You don't ever turn it off, do you?" "Is it a crime to look at a pretty woman, George?" Loisel asked, with a wink. "Suppose not. Maybe we'll catch her on the flip side," Sergeant Tomlinson conceded. She was pretty, but Tomlinson was married with four kids. Louis Loisel never turned it off. Maybe it came along with being French, the American thought. At the bottom, the rest of the team was waiting. Noonan and Steve Lincoln were supervising the baggage transfer. 3 minutes later, Team 2 was in a pair of vans heading off the flight line with a police escort. This was noted by the tower controller, whose brother was a police reporter for a local paper. The cop who'd come to the tower departed without more than a danke to the controllers. 20 minutes later, the van stopped outside the main entrance to Schloss Ostermann. Chavez walked over to the senior officer. "Hello, I am Major Chavez. This is Dr. Bello and Sergeant Major Price," he said. "Surprised to receive a salute from..." "Captain Wilhelm Altmark," the man said. "What do we know?" "We know there are two criminals inside, probably more, but the number is unknown. Do you know what their demands are?"
"Airplane to somewhere was the last I heard. Midnight deadline?"
"Correct. No changes in the past hour."
"Anything else?"
"How will we get them to the airport?" Ding asked. "Herr Ostermann has a private helicopter and pad about 200 meters behind the house."
"Flight crew?"
"We have them over there," Altmark pointed. "Our friends have not yet asked for the flight, but that seems the most likely method of making the transfer."
"Who's been speaking with them?" Dr. Bello asked, from behind the shorter Chavez.
"I have,"
Altmark replied.
Okay, we need to talk, Captain.
Chavez headed over to a van, where he could change along with the rest of the team. For this night's mission, the sun was just setting, they wore not black but mottled green coveralls over their body armor. Weapons were issued and loaded, then selector switches went to